The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. We're pleased to have with us today philosophy professor and author Dr. Massimo Pigliucci. We'll be discussing his new book, Nonsense on Stilts, How to Tell Science from Bunk. I have a few news items before we get to Massimo. We'd like to say hello to a lovely radio station, CILU 102.7 FM, in Thunder Bay, Ontario. We're delighted to tell you that LU Radio has recently started rebroadcasting Skeptically Speaking. So to those of you in Thunder Bay listening right now, welcome and thank you. And I wanted to mention a YouTube video I saw recently, Applied Kinesiology, How It's Done. This was put out by the Skeptic Zone podcast out of Australia, and it's a straightforward and accessible explanation of what applied kinesiology is and how it doesn't actually have any effect on the human body. And if nothing else, you'll get to watch Richard Saunders vaguely wrestling with a series of volunteers, which is both informative and adorable. Take a look for yourself on YouTube. Just search for the Skeptic Zone podcast channel. And the Center for Inquiry Vancouver is holding a lecture, A Primer on A-Hole Skepticism. Now, that title has two more S's in it, but if I say them as part of the title, I will get into trouble with the American rebroadcasters. So here to tell us about it is the presenter, Kennedy Goodkey. Kennedy is an actor, producer of the film The Beast of Bottomless Lake, and contributor to Skeptic North, the pan-Canadian skeptical blog. Welcome, Kennedy.
Hey, Desiree. How you doing?
Very well. So that's an interesting choice for the name of a presentation, sir.
Well, I have to admit I'm a bit of a late fill-in. I mean, a couple of weeks lead time. But as far as promoting it, we had to go fast. So I had to decide the title immediately.
But that is a very descriptive term for a certain type of skepticism.
Well, when I was at TAM 7 last year, I started thinking about how a large segment of the skeptical community, and I think largely it's fueled by scientists, and it's all very well-meaning, have a very specific communication style, which is focused largely on playing well with others. But it also involves a number of negative characteristics, which include going far too far into detail, which can bore the heck out of some people. And I also think that there is a time and place where being respectful to either the people you're talking to or the purveyors of woo really is a detriment to your message. So I started my own blog, Confessions of an A-Hole Skeptic, and started exploring the other possibilities for communicating in ways which rely a little less on being nice on the surface. Ironically, it's not really about being a jerk. It's about communicating in ways which are going to speak to a different segment of the population than who we typically speak to as skeptics.
This is definitely a hot topic right now. There's a lot of disagreement around the best way to do science and skeptical outreach. So would you say that this presentation is a defense of your certain unnameable on the air brand of skepticism?
Not so much, though I suppose in a de facto way it would be. Actually, you know what? Yes, I'm going to go back on that and say, yes, it is a defense of it. But by in the process of explaining what it is, I mean, a lot of people hear the name, and I deliberately chose the name because I knew it would be provocative, but I think maybe I underestimated how people were going to take it. And a lot of people do assume that it's about being a jerk to people, whereas really that is only the tiniest sliver of it and shouldn't be in the equation most of the time. Just more about being more provocative. Anyway, the point being that my presentation is more about explaining the other sides of A-hole skepticism.
Well, I and skeptically speaking by extension use our patented, enthusiastic, let's go find out about science together kind of skepticism. So do you hate us?
Not at all. Not at all. If it wasn't for you guys, I wouldn't be in the movement. So, you know, you brought this upon yourselves.
Okay, well, I don't mean to spoil the ending of your lecture, but do you think there's a place to use the in-your-face type of outreach alongside the friendlier kind?
Absolutely. I think that the friendlier kind does have a certain tendency to sit back and wait for the interested parties to come to you. And there's also a certain requirement or value in having somebody who's going to, instead of sit behind the table and wait for the people to come to you, who's going to stand up on the table and say, hey, look over here. Look, there's something going on. And then once they're over here, they say, okay, go talk to him, the guy behind the table, because he's a much better debater than me. And he also has a better grasp of the facts.
Give me an example of when using your method would be appropriate.
I think there's a certain segment of our opponents, for lack of a better term, who we will never reach. And to a certain point, it's pointless to argue directly with them. So in my mind, they kind of make themselves fair game. I mean, if, you know, rationally, you're not going to sit down at the table, then now you're on the menu. So there are people who are better reached by comedy or a certain approach that sort of intrigues people by its whimsy. And some people will be drawn in more by that. But some people get bored to tears by a breakdown on, you know, the details of exactly how homeopathy works. And they just sort of already know that, wait a second, this sounds like garbage. And I'm going to butcher his name. When they see Darrow Barbervan, what's his name, the comedian, on YouTube, they go, hey, he's right. I know this is the truth. This is logically sound.
So you're saying a more bombastic method works with some people, but the quieter, kind of plodding, a bit meandering approach works better with other people.
Absolutely. Some people need the details, and some people just need to be shown that there are people on side.
So are you recording this presentation?
I believe so. That's the intention. We're actually working with a filmmaker to try and do a fairly skookum, boy, there's a Canadian word. sorry, American listeners, a presentation of it.
So when and where is the lecture?
It's on Friday, May 28th at 7 p.m. at Simon Fraser University Harbor Center here in Vancouver.
And if people want to find out more?
They can go to the CFI Canada website at cficanada.ca, Vancouver Events. Also, it will be on my blog, which is A-hole spelled properly, aholeskeptic.blogspot.com.
Thanks very much for being here, Kennedy.
Thanks, Des.
And now to Speaking Up. We're here with Nicole Gallucci. Nicole is a graduate student in radio astronomy at the University of Virginia. She's the author of the blog One Astronomer's Noise, and she recently started writing for Discovery News. She's here today to tell us about a new project she's working on at UVA called Dark Skies, Bright Kids. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Nicole.
Hi, thank you, Desiree.
So what is Dark Skies, Bright Kids?
Dark Skies, Bright Kids is a program that was started at the University of Virginia last fall by Kelsey Johnson, who is an astronomer at UVA. It's an idea to use the natural resource that we have in Central Virginia, mainly the dark, beautiful night skies, and bring it to elementary school kids.
What's the age range then?
The club is for third through fifth graders. It's an after-school club. We go there pretty much every week. We have about 15 of them that applied to be in this club. We do all kinds of astronomy activities with them. And then hopefully, if the skies are clear at night, we take them outside for some nighttime observing with telescopes.
So what kind of activities exactly would you do?
So we do lots of hands-on activities to teach some concept of astronomy. And we do hands-on, fun, playing type activities. So the idea is that they're learning through playing. We've done some really cool stuff like making your own comet. We've got a lesson plan for this one up already. It's using dry ice and basically mud and Windex and rocks and a bunch of things that are analogous to what you might find in a comet. And they get to squish it together and make this comet that outgasses. And so they're playing with mud. And well, the dry ice, we don't let them touch too much. But they're basically playing with mud and dry ice. But they're learning something about science along the way. And we do things like crater activities. They get to make their own craters and learn how you can throw a bigger object to make a bigger crater. We've done scale models of the solar system, particularly an edible scale model of the solar system, which is really awesome because the Earth and Venus are the size of nerds. They get candy along the way. And the one that I'm unfortunately missing because I'm at an observatory right now, they're building and launching their own rockets. When we did this last semester, they just absolutely went wild. They loved doing this activity.
I assume the response to all of these activities is favorable.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I have to put a little plug here. I am working on a podcast for the 365 Days of Astronomy podcast, and it includes clips of the kids doing a bunch of activities. And so you can hear their excitement. You may want to turn your volume down when that comes out.
So how do parents and teachers respond?
The response has been really great from parents and teachers. We've got some quotes from parents and stuff on the website saying, you know, they came home from this club and all they did was talk about it and talk about what they learned. And so, you know, even, you know, weeks later, they're telling their parents and teaching their parents about constellations and different things that they see.
And you've been providing lesson plans as well?
Yeah. So this program started last fall. It's a core group of grad students and postdocs and undergrads at UVA, along with Kelsey Johnson, putting together these activities and lesson plans. And so the first semester, we kind of just making it up as we went along and, you know, seeing what works and what doesn't. And second semester, we're refining them. And so we're finally writing these up and publishing them on our website so that anybody can go and look at what we've done. A lot of the ideas we've taken from various places on the web, and some of this stuff's already out there, like making your own comet, but we're kind of describing what worked for us and what didn't, and how we did this activity so that teachers or parents or other astronomy clubs can do this with their students.
You've also trained stuffed animals to blog?
Yes, because when grad students need to procrastinate, they will do things like make stuffed animals blog. We have a mascot. We've done this program at two different schools now. We've taken the mascot of the school and bought a stuffed animal version. And what it does is it comes to the club every week. And, it, you know, the kids just love, they name the stuffed animal with something astronomical. So we have a panther named Pluto Little Dippy because they couldn't decide between Pluto and Little Dippy. And we have a yellow jacket called Buzznaut, which they didn't know there was actually an astronaut named Buzz at the time until we told them. And so what these things do is the kids get to play with them during the week. And then when any of us go off to some major observatory, we bring them with us, take pictures, you know, kind of like the roaming gnome. And then we, you know, in our copious free time, a.k.a. procrastination, we started blogging from the stuffed animals points of view. So that's kind of fun if you want to read that.
So where have the stuffed animals been?
Pluto Little Dippy came with me to Florida to see the launch of the space shuttle, STS-130, and the Solar Dynamics Observatory. It's also been with a bunch of grad students that went out to the Southwest, and they visited a whole bunch of observatories. They got to go to the Large Binocular Telescope in Arizona, and they went to the Very Large Array in New Mexico, and they took this along with them. And most recently, they've both came to Green Bank, West Virginia with me to the radio observatory out here. And so when the telescopes were down, so I didn't cause interference, I took some pictures of our stuffed animals hanging out with the radio telescopes.
This is brilliant.
It's fun. And, you know, when you're on a 13-hour drive to Florida, it's kind of nice to have a stuffed animal with you.
So what kinds of things do they write about then? And I assume it's written very accessibly for the children.
So we've just got a few up right now. They're pretty much, they're picture heavy. So we put up the pictures and kind of describe what they do. And, you know, they say, well, I hung out with my friend Nicole and she took me to this cool place. And, you know, and talk about the astronomy, the same level that we talk about it in the meetings in the afternoons.
So how many schools are you looking forward to getting involved?
I think we're going to stick with the two schools for now. We had some talk about whether we'd split our resources and do both schools at once or do multiple schools. And I just don't think we have enough volunteers for that yet. So we focus on one school at a time. We've got relationships with these two schools. Don't know how far we're going to expand yet. This kind of started as a, you know, this great idea of Kelsey's and taking a life of its own. So it depends on how much help and how much funding we get.
Funding is the key.
Yes, yes, yes.
So you're working on a book as well?
Yeah, one of the volunteers who's a student at UVA, Laura Jackson, made these really great illustrations, and she made them out of like cutting out pieces of construction paper. And she made these astronomy illustrations, like an astronaut and a star and a bunch of planets. And so since we didn't actually get to use them as an activity, what we did is we started making a book. So a few volunteers got together and put this book together, wrote descriptions of each of these things in English and Spanish. We printed out a bunch of test copies. We've given out some of these copies and gotten feedback from people. We took it to the American Astronomical Society meeting in January back in D.C. So we've gotten some good feedback. We are going back and restructuring the book. I mean, obviously the planet question, you know, where right. do you put Pluto? Because the kids want to see Pluto. Oh, my gosh. We've been restructuring it for that and for other things. Improving on the translations and the descriptions. In the back, there's descriptions for the adults in the book. Don't know exactly what the plan is yet as far as getting money for publishing. We're hoping to make it available at least as a PDF on the website once it's all finished up. So that'll be a cute thing for kids to share with their parents.
Your procrastination is quite productive.
Thank you. Don't tell us that too much.
Honestly, where were you when I was in grade 3?
I don't know. Probably with my first little telescope.
So what's next for you personally?
Well, I am continuing in the graduate program at UVA. I'm working on a project called Paper, which I'm sure I've blogged about. It's all online. So I've got a couple more years on that project. We're building a low-frequency telescope. I hope continuing with the Dark Skies Bright Kids, because I really enjoy that. And I'm also teaching my first class this summer. And UVA students are listening. It's going to be awesome. You should take it. It's called Life Beyond Earth. And it'll be a semester-long course squished into a month. And it's my first class that I get to teach all by myself.
I am so sure you will be fantastic. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Where can people find out more about Dark Skies Bright Kids?
You can go to the Astronomy at UVA website. It's www.astro.virginia.edu/DSBK. We've got All About Us, and we've got pictures of some of our activities. The resources link is where you can find lesson plans as they are, you know, as procrastinating grad students, slowly get them together and put those up. And then a link to the blog as well, so you can see what our mascots are up to.
And where can we find your writing?
I'm at noisyastronomer.com. That's my personal blog, which has been somewhat ignored in recent days. But you can also go to the Discovery News space blog where I've started writing, and that has been really, really great fun to be writing for them.
Congratulations. That's wonderful that they picked you up. And thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Desiree. This was so much fun.
And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking right after this.
You are listening to Skeptically Speaking, either through the wonder of podcast technology or the generosity of one of our rebroadcasting stations. Skeptically Speaking is broadcast live out of CJSR 88.5 Edmonton, Alberta at 6 p.m. Mountain Time every Friday. If you're not in Edmonton, you can still hear the broadcast live in our Ustream.tv feed, which you can find by clicking on the Listen Live link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also participate in the chat room and submit questions. During the week leading up to each show, you can find information on the upcoming episode and guest and submit a question to be asked on the air. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Our deepest thanks go to those stations that donate their valuable airtime to our program, including Citywide LPFM 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, CJLY Kootenai Cooperative Radio 93.5 FM in Nelson, 96.5 FM in Crawford Bay, and 107.5 FM in New Denver, British Columbia, CIVL 101.7 FM in Abbotsford, British Columbia, CJAI Amherst Island Public Radio 92.1 FM in Stella, Ontario, CLHI Rosslyn Radio 101.1 FM in Rosslyn, British Columbia, Freethought Radio, WPRR Public Reality Radio 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan, CIDO 97.7 FM in Creston, British Columbia, UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, CFAD 92.1 FM in Salmo, British Columbia, CLHS 100.5 FM in Lillooet, British Columbia, CKOA FM, The Coast 89.7 FM in Cape Breton, Glace Bay, Nova Scotia, CKMS 100.3 in Waterloo, Ontario, and CILU 102.7 FM in Thunder Bay, Ontario.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Massimo Pigliucci.
Massimo has a doctorate in genetics, a PhD in evolutionary biology, a PhD in philosophy, and is currently professor of philosophy at the City University of New York. He writes for a myriad of skeptical and technical magazines. He blogs at rationallyspeaking.org. And Nonsense on Stilts, How to Tell Science from Bunk, is his 12th book. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Massimo.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Massimo, Nonsense on Stilts is an incredibly accessible deconstruction of what makes science science. So how long have you been working on this book?
The actual writing probably took a little more than a year, which is actually fairly fast. But the material has been accumulated in my files for a long time, and I've been, of course, writing on and off on those topics for some time. So I'd say that my estimate is probably maybe 3 or 4 years of work.
And this is your 12th book?
Correct, although the first two were in Italian, so you can't find them on Amazon.
So you start the book by breaking down the difference between hard science and soft science.
Yeah, because that's an interesting distinction that some people vehemently denied. Typically, those are the scientists who are stuck on the soft science side of things. And other scientists, are, on the other hand, insist that there is a very sharp distinction between hard and soft science, and those typically tend to be scientists that work in the hard sciences. And I wanted to know, as a philosopher and scientist, well, what exactly is this distinction? Turns out that there is no exact distinction, but there are some general characteristics that are interesting. So the typical example of a hard science, of course, is fundamental physics. It's based on experiments. The experiments are very precise. They're highly repeatable. The theory is highly developed and based on mathematical formulations. And the typical example of a soft science is psychology. And in psychology, it turns out that the experiments are actually also surprisingly quite repeatable. There is literature that shows that when psychologists repeat the same kind of experiment under similar conditions, just like physicists do, the results turned out to be the same. So that's encouraging. What makes psychology less of a hard science than physics are two things. First of all, the results of experiments are typically not very precise. So although they're repeatable, there's a large variation in the results themselves, which, of course, is attributable to the fact that human beings are much more complicated than quarks. So it's not the psychologist's fault. It's just that they deal with things that are much more complicated than what physicists work with. But the other reason why psychology is considered typically a soft science is because there is no overarching theory. So there is nothing in psychology that is equivalent to, say, the general theory of relativity in physics, or quantum mechanical theory in physics, or even theory of evolution in biology. So psychology is a science for sure. It proceeds by observation and experiment. It does test hypotheses, and those are the basic characteristics of a science, but it doesn't seem to be an overarching theory, and the question is why.
Well, you also say that hard science is better at predictions.
Yes, hard science is better at prediction, and again, the typical example is fundamental physics. But there is a trade-off there. High science is better at predicting things, but that's usually because of one of two things. Either because it deals with very simple or relatively simple processes and phenomena. You know, again, atoms, molecules, even planets, mm-hmm. sort of, in some respect, are much simpler objects of study than living organisms, for instance. So there's the advantage of dealing with simple things that are more predictable. They don't behave in haphazard manners. The other reason is because in fundamental physics, you can do experiments under highly controlled conditions, which lead to a high degree of predictability. But as soon as you move physics into the real world, for instance, if we move from fundamental physics to, say, non-equilibrium thermodynamics or atmospheric physics, then all bets are off. The degree of predictability in atmospheric physics is very low. I mean, as you probably know, if you want to trust the weather forecast beyond 2 or 3 days, you are fooled, because there is essentially no predictability beyond a very limited time range.
So with the soft sciences, then there's just too many variables to control for?
Yes, that's one of the problems. There are too many variables to control, and even when you can control them, the systems under study are still very complex, and they are amenable only to statistical treatments and sort of broad conclusions, but there's a limit that is imposed by the complexity of the system itself. However, as I said a minute ago, there is a difference between some certain soft sciences and others. So some people would consider, for instance, evolutionary biology a borderline soft science. It's certainly not as hard as physics. Mm-hmm. And yet evolutionary biology does rely on an overarching structure that is provided by the Darwinian theory and by its further expansions over the last several decades, something that psychology doesn't have.
But as you said, soft science is still science, not to be confused with almost science.
That's correct. So soft science is certainly established science, such as, again, psychology or sociology. Now, almost science begins to be one of those categories that could easily, in the future, either become actual sciences or slide back into pseudoscience. So, for instance, one of the best examples I can think of is evolutionary psychology. Evolutionary psychology it's got all the basics of a science because it is an offshoot of basic evolutionary theory. So the theory is sound. I mean, the idea that human behaviors evolved just like other animals' behaviors is certainly uncontroversial. The idea that some of those behaviors evolved by natural selection is also fairly uncontroversial. The devil, however, is in the details. It turns out that a lot of evolutionary psychologists, not all of them, but a lot of evolutionary psychologists focus their attention on precisely the worst kind of human traits from a point of view of scientific study. They are interested in things that are, in behaviors that are universal and unique among humans. The reasoning behind that is that they want to know what is it that makes us human.
Right? Right.
So for something, the idea is that for something to make us human, it has to be both universal, there has to be no exceptions in human society, and it has to be uniquely human as opposed to, say, a trait that we share with other primates or other mammals. Well, it turns out, unfortunately, that for a series of reasons that have to do with historical accidents and with the availability of empirical information, those are exactly the traits that are essentially almost impossible to study scientifically. There's no replicability. There's no other species that have those traits. It's difficult to get the historical record. So that puts evolutionary psychology into a sort of borderline area where, depending on where the field is going over the next several years, it may actually slide into a pseudoscience. Or it may emerge as a soft science. I don't think it will ever go beyond the soft science.
There was actually an article that I read a while back that stated, selling sex is said to be humankind's oldest profession, but it may have deep evolutionary roots, according to a study into our primate cousins, which found that male macaques pay for intercourse using grooming as a currency. And then they said, there is a very well-known mix of economic and mating markets in the human species itself. There are many examples of rich old men getting young, attractive ladies. So that falls into the almost science category?
Well, all right, so let's analyze this claim in a little bit of detail, because it is an interesting one, and in fact, it is typical of evolutionary psychology. So the basic claim is probably uncontroversial. I mean, the idea that females in general, almost across every species, there are some exceptions, but across every species, are the ones that basically make the decisions in terms of mate selection. It's true, because females are the ones that have the most invested in the offspring. They spend more time and energy with the offspring than males do, typically. As I said, there are exceptions to the rule. And that goes not just for humans. It goes also for pretty much every primate. It goes for most mammals. In fact, it goes for most animal species that we know of. If that is the case, and that's certainly a very well empirically established observation, then yes, there are some behaviors that are predictable. Males will behave in a certain way, and females will behave in a certain way across the board. But that's not a trait that is unique to humans. Right? That is a trait that we actually share with a large number of species. So that one, I'm actually more confident that is, in fact, the result of evolution. But even so, there is only so much that evolutionary psychology can tell us about the specifics of human behavior in modern cultures. I mean, you can make the argument that, you know, for a male to buy a sports car or a large house or having a big bank account, those are all essentially variations on the same theme, that the male is simply trying to impress the female, showing her that he's got what it takes to raise the offspring and give assurance for the future. Fine. But evolutionary psychology tells us precisely nothing about which forms that kind of behavior will take.
Right.
I mean, evolutionary psychology doesn't tell us anything about bank accounts and sports cars, or anything like that, for the simple reason, obviously, that those are not evolved behavior, those are cultural behaviors. So the idea is that the basic behavior certainly is evolved, But the many, many, many different forms that that behavior takes in human societies are the result of cultural evolution or cultural norms, and therefore that's where evolutionary psychology hits the limit.
Anything after that point is almost an informed guess, then?
Yes, anything after that is an informed guess. And in fact, I would say that anything beyond that point is really not the realm of evolutionary psychology anymore. It is the realm of social science.
Right.
I mean, there is this idea, unfortunately, that seems to be very popular, that evolution can explain everything. And, you know, as a philosopher, I can tell you that if a theory can explain everything, that is essentially empty. It doesn't actually explain anything. Evolutionary theory is a very powerful theory. It has a very large domain of application. It's applicable to a lot of different things. But it doesn't tell you everything, and it certainly tells you very little about human culture. It tells you something about human culture, but not a lot. And the problem with a lot of evolutionary psychology is that these authors tend to overstep the sort of the epistemological boundaries, as they would be called in philosophy. In other words, they claim more than what they can claim based on the data.
If you'd like to ask Massimo a question about how to separate the pseudo from the science, you can email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com. So I mentioned pseudoscience, and it's often ridiculously difficult for we lay people to tell the difference between that and the almost science that you just spoke about. So what are some guidelines around that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Again, the point of the book is to show that the landscape that is populated by hard science, soft science, pseudoscience, you know, quasi-science, and so on. It's a very complex landscape. It's fascinating. I mean, it's really interesting to get into. But it can be very confusing for people, of course, that do not have a background in either science or in philosophy of science. But, however, there are some telling signs of a pseudoscience. Let's take a typical example of pseudoscience. That's astrology. I hope not many of your listeners actually consult the horoscope on a regular basis, or in fact, even on a occasional basis, because they'll be disappointed, and they'll be wasting time and sometimes even money if they actually pay for an astrologer. Now, why is astrology a pseudoscience? Well, for a variety of reasons that are typical of pseudoscience. First of all, the fundamental theory is entirely flawed, and it's been known to be flawed for centuries. So the basic idea behind astrology, of course, is that the particular configurations of stars in the sky at moment of birth influences people's personality and eventually even events that occurred in their lifetime. Well, the problem is that those configurations, which are called constellations, don't actually exist. They are an optical illusion. Stars appear to be members of a group that we call a constellation, but in fact, the stars that are inside in a particular constellation actually happen to be at very, very different distances from the Earth. And which means that we only see them as a group because of a matter of perspective. So it's like if you were walking down the street here in Manhattan and you were walking by the Empire State Building and I saw you in front of the Empire State Building but several blocks away, I would say, wow, you are very tall. You're almost as tall as the Empire State Building. Now, that would be false. The thing is that you're much closer to me than the Empire State Building is, and as a matter of perspective, I see you in this distorted proportion. It's the same thing with constellations. So constellations don't exist. Now, you would think that once a notion or a hypothesis or a theory has been demolished at that level, in other words, there's nothing there at a theoretical level, that should be enough to spell the end of that particular practice, but obviously we know that hasn't happened. The second reason astrology is a pseudoscience is because it also happens that it doesn't work. People have actually done experiments. People have done experiments in which they provided a particular profile, personality profile, to a large number of professional astrologers, and they asked the astrologers to pick the sign that would go with that personality. And the chances of the professional astrologers of getting it right were exactly those that you would expect if they were picking at random. In other words, you and I would be as good as a professional astrologer at picking somebody's horoscope. In other words, astrology fails both theoretically and empirically, and yet a lot of people practice it and a lot of more people believe it. And that's the hallmark of a pseudoscience. It's something that is well known to be theoretically flawed. It's well known not to work empirically, and yet people insist in believing it. That's the quintessential example of a pseudoscience.
So you mention in the book that belief in pseudoscience can also be seen as kind of a protest, specifically against the impersonalization and specialization of modern science.
Right. So there is a well-known psychological phenomenon that seems to be pretty widespread that brings people to reject things that either they don't understand or that they're presented to them as the ultimate truth and telling them things that they don't particularly like. So, for instance, you know, the obvious example here is the theory of evolution and the resistance that it has in the United States. About 45 to 50% of Americans don't believe in evolution. And the question is, well, why? There are several reasons for it. Of course, part of it goes down to a strong streak of religious fundamentalism. In other words, evolution is telling people what they don't want to hear, that we are, in fact, closely related to other animals, that we are the result of a natural process, and so on and so forth. So that's the first level of rejection. But the other thing that makes people skeptical is this idea that there is a distrust of intellectualism. There is a reaction, especially in the United States, against intellectuals. And you can see this also in the recent controversies about climate change. You know, that's the same idea. Oh, these people with PhD, they think that they can tell you everything, you know, or how to behave or what the world is really like just because they have a PhD. Well, no, it's not just because they have a PhD, although typically a PhD is a requirement to get going on a scientific career. But the reason climate scientists or evolutionary biologists are telling us what they are telling us is because they have actually looked at the empirical evidence and they've reached certain conclusions. Now, scientific conclusions are never certain. They're always open to revision. They're always open to debate. But they're not open to debate by somebody who doesn't know anything about a particular field and just says, well, I don't believe it. I mean, that would be like me, for instance, with a background in evolutionary biology, going to a quantum physicist and say, yeah, I just don't believe this stuff about quantum mechanics. I mean, you guys tell me that the table on which I'm having dinner tonight is made of mostly empty space or it's permeated by invisible fields. I think that's a lot of crap, and I'm just not going to believe it. Well, I would be wrong. Even though I have a PhD, it's a PhD in the wrong field in that case. It's not in quantum mechanics, and I'm certainly not an expert. What I find interesting in that attitude is that it seems to apply only to academic and intellectual discussions. It doesn't apply almost anywhere else. I mean, in any other area of life, we do trust expertise. You know, presumably most of us, if they have a problem with our car, we go to a mechanic. Unless you are a mechanic yourself, you go to a mechanic. And typically you trust what your mechanic says. I mean, if you're very dissatisfied, you go to another mechanic if you can't fix the thing. But typically, we go to an expert. You know, if you have a problem with your teeth, you go to a dentist. If you have a problem with your brain, you go to a neurosurgeon or to a psychiatrist. I mean, you don't just go and say, well, I don't believe these people with expertise. I'm just going to do it on my own. So I find it's very peculiar that this degree of overt skepticism is apparently applies only or almost exclusively to intellectual endeavors. And the reason for that is because there has been, in the United States, a very long history of anti-intellectualism, which goes back to the beginning of the country itself.
But you also tell a story about UFOs in the context of pseudoscience that's a bit of a warning to skeptics about the danger of our arrogance.
That's right. So obviously UFOs, as in flying saucers coming from another planet, are another example of pseudoscience. I mean, every time that we've looked into claims of extraterrestrial visitations closely enough, we found that they were either made up or they were more likely the result of the observation of a natural phenomenon or of a human-made phenomenon, which was simply misinterpreted. But the couple of the stories that I tell in the book are, as you say, a warning to skeptics because there is a tendency in certain skeptics' quarters to just dismiss things out of hand without actually doing the work of figuring out what it is that those people actually saw. So the examples that I tell this in the book are cases in which, you know, a local skeptic was interviewed after, say, some people claimed to have seen a flying saucer, and he said, oh, well, it was probably a meteor. And it turned out it wasn't a meteor. In fact, there was no meteor that would fit the description. There was no observation by local astronomers fitting the observation. What it was, for instance, a satellite in one case that was sent out by the Japanese. Now, I think that a crucial aspect of being skeptical, of engaging in critical thinking, is not the idea that you reject claims because they seem absurd. I mean, that's not being a skeptic. That's just being a cynic to some extent. It's just denying things for the sake of denying it. The idea of skepticism is that you inquire. You do the work. And you cannot just sit down at your computer. Somebody calls you up and says, hey, a bunch of people have seen UFOs. What do you think of it? Oh, it's a meteor. Well, no. You can't just make it up. You have to do your work. Was there, in fact, a large meteor that night that tracked by astronomers or by radar and that fits the characteristics of the alleged UFO? If not, then it clearly wasn't a meteor. And you have to look for another explanation. I don't doubt that another natural explanation was, in fact, available, and it turned out to be available in that case. But you had to find it. You had to do the work. So being a skeptic doesn't mean that you can get lazy. You actually have to get the butt off your chair and your eyes off of Google and the Internet and just do the actual investigation.
So is this connected to a term that you use, scientism?
Yes, it is. Now, scientism, it's an interesting term. It's used mostly by philosophers, and it is an insult. It's not a compliment. You know, nobody wants to be accused of being scientistic. Engaging in scientism means that one is overstretching the domain of science, that one is making claims on behalf of science that are simply not supportable, that one is saying that science would answer any question that we have given enough time and money, or that scientific questions are the only questions that have meaning or that are interesting, and so on and so forth. It's a very common disease among scientists. It's certainly not universal, but there are a lot of my colleagues in the sciences who do suffer from scientism. They make claims that are exaggerated, especially when they talk to the general public. And it's also very diffuse among skeptics in the skeptic community. And the reason for that, of course, is because most people become skeptic because they're interested in science. They love the science. And, you know, so am I. But being in love, unfortunately, sometimes means that you don't see the defects of the person right in front of you because you're in love. And you don't have that objective detachment that is needed to actually assess the situation. So there is a danger in scientism because, first of all, it may lead to that kind of embarrassing situation as the one that I was talking about earlier. You know, somebody making up an explanation for a paranormal phenomenon, and then it turns out that explanation is in fact flatly wrong. Well, that's embarrassing, or it should be embarrassing. But there are more important consequences. I think that if one promises too much on behalf of science, and then science doesn't deliver because it cannot deliver everything that one promises, then we lose credibility. Science loses credibility. And science already has a PR problem. We don't need to make it any worse by making extraordinary claims which we cannot actually back up with the proper evidence or the proper follow-up. So I think it's a matter of being careful of what one says and communicating to the public in a way that is reasonable and especially that makes sure that the public understands that A, not all questions are amenable to a scientific answer. Not all interesting questions are intrinsically scientific in nature. But more importantly, that even when science works at its best, it is in fact only provisional. It only gives us answers that seem to be right at the moment, given the available evidence. But if new evidence comes in, the answers might turn out to be wrong. And a good scientist, of course, recognizes that. But it's important to prepare the general public for that, because otherwise you have, again, an increasing sense of skepticism. You know, when you read in newspapers that wine is good for you or caffeine is good for you, and then 6 months later, scientists find out that it's bad for you, and another year passes, and actually scientists find out that it's good for you again. Well, what is one supposed to do? Am I supposed to drink wine and coffee or not? Of course, the answer is yes in both cases, in moderation. But you lose credibility if you keep going back and forth on things without explaining that is the nature of the scientific process.
If you have a question for Massimo, email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. We'll take a break and be right back with more Skeptically Speaking.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we talk to Australian journalist and author Vanessa Woods about her new book, Bonobo Handshake. Memoir takes us inside Lola Ya Bonobo Sanctuary, a refuge for orphan baby bonobos in the Congo. Wood will share her story about living and working amongst these highly social primates. And science blogger Greg Layton joins us for Everything You Know Is Sort of Wrong, a new feature exposing the truth behind some commonly held beliefs. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm on the line with Massimo Pigliucci, the author of Nonsense on Stilts, How to Tell Science from Bunk. I've actually been enjoying talking to Massimo, so, but now it's your turn. And we have a lot of listener questions. Go ahead.
Are you able to quiz Massimo as to why his accommodationist stance regarding religion and science's supposed compatibility is not another example of bunk? For many, including I, think it is bunk to declare that science and religion are compatible on most assertions that most religious folk hold dear. I'm not referring to the fact that scientists can be religious, which is clearly true, but I get the impression that Massimo has implied that the core philosophies of both are compatible. That's from Michael Kingsford Gray.
Yes, it's a great question. I was expecting a question about accommodationism. So perhaps I can try to clear the record once more. I've actually tried this before and it didn't work, but I'll try it again. I am not an accommodationist. I do not think that science and religion are compatible. What I do think is that science cannot disprove what Richard Dawkins famously called the God hypothesis simply because God is not a hypothesis. It's nothing like a scientific hypothesis. We were talking about the limitations of science, and this is a classic example of scientism. I think that Dawkins is one of the best examples of scientific writers that I know of these days. The claim that science can refute the supernatural is mistaken, and is based on a bad understanding of the epistemology of science. Science deals with natural processes, not with supernatural ones. So that's what I'm saying, that science cannot disprove the God hypothesis simply because the God hypothesis is not actually a hypothesis. What science can do and does very well is to disprove specific statements made by religious people. So if you are a creationist who believes in the Earth being 6,000 years old, well, sorry, you're wrong. Science definitely tells us that the Earth is not 6,000 years old. Now, what you do with that knowledge in terms of your religion is, in fact, your problem. It's not science's problem. If knowing that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old is enough to let you go of God, well, okay, that's your decision. But there are, of course, plenty of religious people, and Christians in particular, who have absolutely no trouble accommodating the discoveries of science within whatever their view of religion is. And the reason they have no trouble doing that is, again, because religions are not scientific hypotheses. They're infinitely malleable. And if they're infinitely malleable, then there is not really much that one can say from a scientific perspective to conclusively show that there is no God. I think that the question of the existence of God is a philosophical question. It is certainly a question that is informed by science, but it cannot be determined by science because science is limited to natural processes. But I am not an accommodationist because I actually don't think that there is a compatibility between science and religion. And the reason I don't think there is a compatibility is because, at its best, science is about open inquiry based on empirical data. And if the empirical data tells you a different story from what you think, you really ought to change your mind. Religion, on the other hand, is exactly the opposite. It is a set of beliefs that is impervious to empirical data. As I said, it's infinitely malleable. The empirical data are either rejected, as in the case of creationists who claim that evolution is wrong, or they're simply accommodated within whatever religious framework one already has, as in the case of mainstream Christians. So I think that there is an incompatibility between science and religion, but it's mostly a matter of attitude. It's a matter of how they proceed, what kind of belief systems they actually are.
I've been reading you for quite a while now, and in the course of that, I've seen you referred to as one of the loud and brash militant skeptics, and also as an apologist or an accommodationist. So what do you think about those terms, and also, I guess, how they're used towards you specifically?
Well, one of the people that regularly comments on my blog at some point said, look, if you manage to be labeled both a scientific writer and an accommodationist, you must be doing something right because you're pissing off both sides of the debate. It's easy to throw out labels, unfortunately, and we're all pretty much guilty of that thing. Sometimes I do the same. But we need to be careful with the terms. And the terms are, in fact, fairly easy to define. I am certainly not an accommodationist for the reasons that I just explained. I don't believe that that science and religion are compatible, neither as a matter of actual claims that they make, nor, more importantly, as a matter of the kind of activities that they represent. So I'm not an accommodationist. People insist in considering me an accommodationist, fine, but I am not. I just don't fit the bill. Am I a scientistic writer? I mean, there's one of the first reviews of Nonsense on Stilts has been published in the Chronicle of Higher Education. It was a fostering negative review by a fellow named Romano, who is a philosopher at, I believe, the University of Pennsylvania. And he thinks that I am what he defined a science warrior, somebody who uncompromisingly thinks that science is always right and that, that nothing else counts. I think Romano didn't read the book, because half of the book is about cautioning people about the limits of science. I mean, there is an entire chapter in the book, as you know, entitled, you know, do we trust science too much? And the answer is yes at the end of the book. Mm-hmm. There are chapters there on expertise where I warn people not to believe somebody just because he has or she has a PhD. There are plenty of discussions about the complexity of the landscape of science, pseudoscience, where it's not always easy to tell the difference. So where Romano got that idea, I don't know. The ironic thing, I think, that I found in that review was really interesting, is that Romano contrasted my writings with the kinds of things that are published in Skeptical Inquirer magazine, which he feels is not scientific and it's much more balanced and well-equilibrated. Apparently without realizing that, A, I have actually a regular column in Skeptical Inquirer magazine, you know, every issue I publish a column about the nature of science, and B, the editor of Skeptical Inquirer, Ken Fraser, actually wrote a glowing review of the book in this month's issue of the magazine. So, you know, people have obviously entitled their opinions, but I honestly don't see how I would fit either in the scientific or in the accommodationist literature. Now, being somewhere in between, of course, that means that you are, in fact, likely to irritate both sides.
We have another website question.
Recently, both the skeptic and atheist movements have attracted a lot of attention and seem to be growing quickly. Have these movements always existed and just become more noticeable in recent years, or are we seeing something new, possibly fueled by scientific advances and the Internet?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think there are sociological statistics out there to tell us whether this is simply a number of people who were out there already and they're coming out of the closet, so to speak, or if, in fact, the idea of atheism and skepticism is spreading. Somebody should do a PhD thesis in the social sciences, and this would be very interesting to look at. My sense, from having been in the community now for something like 13 years or so, is that there is more visibility. It's more a matter of visibility than a matter of numbers. I mean, the number of people that I see as skeptic events is still as small as it has always been, or maybe not too different from what it's always been. But there's certainly a lot more publicity to the movement. There is obviously, we have had several books the last few years that have hit the New York Times best-selling list, which is obviously an indication that people certainly are interested in these topics. And that's all for the good, within certain limits. Because, as I said, unfortunately, even some of the major authors of the so-called New Atheism tend to make claims that are not quite as rational as they think they are. There is a variety of opinions there, too. I mean, if I had to pick, you know, among the New Atheist authors, I think that Dan Dennett is by far the one that is more reasonable and makes the most interesting claims. The others vary to some extent from Sam Harris, who gets a lot of things right but sometimes goes off on a tangent, to Richard Dawkins, who I find mostly he writes very well, but he's not making a particularly good contribution, in my opinion, because he's too aggressive in his writing. And then there is Christopher Hitchens, who how can you not get upset by listening or reading Christopher Hitchens, even if you're an atheist? It's beyond me. I mean, the guy just has absolutely no interest in communicating with people. He just has an interest in pissing people off, and that's, I found, very unproductive.
And we have another website question. Audience, we're not going to get to all of these today. My apologies.
Denialists also like to focus on small disagreements about details of the science and frame that as showing that the whole field is in disarray. How do we show people that researchers can disagree on particulars without questioning the broader conclusions?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I mean, and it's a very good observation. Absolutely. Denialists of whatever, be it climate change or evolution or the connection between HIV and AIDS and so on and so forth, there are several that I treat in the book. That's what they do. They point to minor anomalies or to discussions within, you know, disagreements among scientists within the field and say, see, you guys don't understand it. You don't, obviously, you're making this stuff up and it is a conspiracy, et cetera, et cetera. While in fact, that is a reflection of the very nature of science. I mean, disagreement among scientists is what keeps science going. I mean, science makes progress precisely because scientists disagree and they want to prove each other wrong, and sometimes they succeed. So this, I think, however, again, is an example where the fault to some extent, not entirely, but to some extent, the fault is the scientists themselves. Because when scientists talk to the general public, when scientists write for the general public, they seem to write not much as about the science as a process, but about science as a set of results, as a body of knowledge. And the impression that the public gets is of this monolithic set of facts that are unquestionable. The public has no or very little understanding of the history of science or how scientific investigations actually proceed, and therefore of the fact that discussions and disagreements are not only normal, but it's vital to the functioning of science. So I think this is a problem with science education. It's interesting to me that Dawkins, for instance, we go back to the same to one person. Dawkins has written a lot of interesting things, and before The God Delusion, he wrote a large number of books of evolutionary biology for the general public, which were very well written, and he was doing that in the capacity, endowed chair. He had an endowed chair before he retired public understanding of science. Well, imagine that. I think that every university should have a chair of or a position of public understanding of science. And while we're at it, I think that every university should have a position of public understanding of philosophy, because it's philosophy that actually teaches critical thinking more even so than science. If we started that way, having that sort of sustained effort at educating the public, I think things will be a little better. But as far as I know, there's only one endowed chair of public understanding of science. That's the one that Dawkins had. And then there's only one endowed chair of public understanding of philosophy, and that's also, interestingly, in England. Neither one of those are in the United States.
Massimo, we are pretty much completely out of time. Thank you so much for being on the show. Absolutely. If you want more of Massimo, head to rationallyspeaking.org. There are links to all of his works, and this gentleman does quite a fine podcast as well. And as for us, we're at skepticallyspeaking.com. Please remember to click the links that take you to our Facebook and Twitter pages and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show and perhaps write a glowing review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
On Skeptically Speaking, we discuss a wide range of skeptical and science topics with a variety of experts. But I'd like to remind you that you, yes, you personally, are invited to join us on air every week for Speaking Up. Because let's face it, outreach is a part of skepticism. We all do it, whether we're talking to our parents about why they shouldn't buy into that multi-level marketing scheme, explaining the misinformation around vaccines to our coworkers, or forwarding that Snopes entry on why typing in your PIN number backward on the ATM machine does not, in fact, summon the police. But if you want to take your skeptical activism one step further and reach a broader audience, we're here for you. Do you have an event coming up that you'd like to promote? Or maybe you're a blogger that's been doing some great work and you'd like to talk about it? Or you'd just like to get some experience speaking publicly on a science or skeptical topic? What better way to get some real-world practice than on a friendly, rational radio show?
If you're ready to have your say, do send an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Put speaking up in the subject line, tell us a bit about what you'd like to discuss, and we'll contact you to set up your very own 10 to 15 minutes of on-air goodness. We're looking forward to hearing from you.